Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. It's the end of the week, and we get to just, as my kid says, smell the soup, cool the soup. We're breathing, okay? End of the week, and we have an out. Did that make any sense? Smell the soup, you're breathing in. Cool the soup, you're breathing out. Okay, I perhaps have belabored that. We are here at the end of the week to talk about what happened this week and what matters about it. And we have Seattle City Council member Kshama Sawant. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Luke Burbank, host of the podcast Too Beautiful to Live, TBTL. And you have a live show coming up at the Neptune in Seattle.
Is that tonight?
Yeah. You shouldn't even be here.
Can you guys handle it from here? I got to go prep that. Yeah, we're doing Livewire at the Neptune Theater tonight.
Yep, Livewire.
Starting it at 8 o'clock. So that up to two propane trucks can crash,
yes.
And you will still be able to make it for
yes.
the Neptune Theater tonight. And I think you can get tickets still at the KUOW events page or at the STG site. So I hope to see people out there tonight.
KUOW.org. Go get your Livewire tickets. I went to the last show. Big fun, by the way. Sat next to Maria Semple.
Oh, really?
Yeah, pretty excited about that. Former King County Council member, former chair of the Washington Republican Party. Hello, Chris Vance.
And former state representative.
Former state
rep. All my formers.
Yes, yes. State representative and former Republican.
No.
Wait a minute. What are you?
I'm a proud Ronald Reagan Republican who refuses to be driven out of his party by today's current leader of our party.
You're kind of famous for this now. Will you please tell us about all the national... attention you're getting.
I didn't mean to, but I wrote an article in Crosscut right after the first executive order that my wife and I were joining the ACLU because we were so outraged by the Muslim ban, which mm-hmm. is what it was and what it is and what it will be. That was picked up by the Huffington Post. Bernie Sanders saw it and put it on his Facebook page. Now the Washington Post is going to run a story about, I don't know if it's just me, but about the ACLU and Republicans. So, yeah.
Kshama Sawant, do you have some socialist literature that you could give Chris?
I have lots that I can share with him. But one really important gem I can share is you're not going to win the base back to the Republican Party by being a nostalgic free trade Reaganite. I've got a newsflash to you. The reason the base ended up voting for Reagan for Trump, who posed himself as an opponent to the Republican and Democratic establishment, is because he, as a con man, lied to them that he's against NAFTA, he is against free trade, that has destroyed so many people's lives. So I think that's where the rub lies.
That's how to be a Republican, Chris Vance.
Yeah, well, I don't need any advice on how to be a Republican, but she's right. I mean, the Republican base has changed over the years, and now I think the overwhelming majority of Republicans are no longer free trade. I think the overwhelming majority of Americans have been conned into believing that we need to be a protectionist nation again, like in the 1800s, and tax products coming into this country, which is economic suicide. But my side has done a terrible job making this case. And so I think the council member is right. I mean, the base of both the Republican and Democratic parties are anti-trade, but it's awful economics will destroy this country.
Well, I think, speaking as an economist, which I also happen to be in addition to being a socialist, I would say that there is a lot of consternation among some sections of big business about Trump's extreme statements about protectionism, because if you actually did what he's recommending in very general terms, it would actually be disastrous. It would trigger recessionary components into the economy. It would trigger joblessness. But that's not what people who oppose free trade are saying. What they're saying is we want an economy which, while it is generating so much wealth, also generate decent living standards for us as working people. What they're outraged about is that NAFTA decimated jobs in the entire Rust Belt. That's what they're talking about. They don't want part two of that with TPP, which is why they supported Bernie Sanders in huge numbers. And, you know, Trump is a con man, so he disingenuously used that.
My question is, what percentage of American jobs are related to manufacturing? If you believed the politicians, it would be 100%.
Right.
I mean, my sense is it's probably not statistically as significant as we think it is, which is not to downplay the effect on people's lives of losing jobs. But I mean, there are a lot of jobs that aren't in the Rust Belt and aren't in coal mines and aren't these. And
we're not talking about coal mines. We're talking about the auto sector. And if you actually look at a lot of the sections of the South, the many of the auto plants that have come up in recent times, and they have. I think while we should not overestimate the manufacturing sector, we also make the mistake of underestimating. And a lot of the new jobs that are getting created are actually not the old kind of jobs. They're not like unionized jobs where you could raise a family with a middle-class standard of living. That's not happening, and that's what people are angry about.
Yeah, but we do know that 40% of the jobs in Washington State are directly related to trade. Doing what Donald Trump proposes by putting huge tariffs on products coming in from the outside will, I'm glad to hear the councilmember say this, will crush the American economy and crush Washington State's economy. He is an old-fashioned mercantilist protectionist, and it's insane economics.
Well, here's an idea to boost the standard of living around here a little bit. This is a new idea for a tax in Seattle. That's where we're going to start our weekend review. Mm-hmm. It's so-called Trump-proofing is what the supporters are calling it. They want the city to tax the investment income of high earners. Councilmember Shama Sawant, did you weep with joy when you heard this?
Well, I didn't exactly weep, but I am part of the coalition that you're talking about, the Trump Proof Seattle. And also, if you recall, I ran my campaigns, and one of the campaign slogans I ran on was tax the rich. So yeah. this is an idea that I have promoted, and also there's a broad-based grassroots coalition now behind it. We had a very successful meeting at City Hall, as you know, this week.
Yeah. Chris Vance, I don't know, you're a Republican. How do you feel about a Seattle investment income tax?
Three things on this. First of all, I live in Auburn, as I point out every time I'm here. So yeah. I don't like coming on the show and lecturing the voters of Seattle about what they should do in their city.
Fair enough.
Second, I understand the angst over, we have not yet seen a budget from Donald Trump, or a healthcare proposal, or an infrastructure proposal, or anything specific. But what he's talking about in terms of his budget is really terrible, because he's talking about dramatically cutting taxes, increasing defense spending, not touching the entitlement programs, which are half the federal budget, and then cutting severely the other 15% of the federal budget, which is everything else, arts, culture, the State Department, human services, everything. It'd be devastating. So I understand Seattle being very worried about Trump's budget if he ever actually proposes one. Third point, though, is it's unconstitutional. The state Supreme Court has ruled multiple times that you cannot have a graduated rate income tax where you tax some people more than others based on their income. That's why we don't have it in this state. So the city of Seattle, it's an interesting idea. I understand why it's attractive, but it's unconstitutional. They can't do it.
But it could go through the courts, and the courts and could change the ruling. Yeah, we'll see.
It seems like a long shot to me, but I didn't think you were going to get the $15 thing pushed through either, Councilwoman. So
I'm telling you.
You know what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
I do think that there's a concern, and I live in Bellingham, so maybe I should recuse myself as well.
But you still, you don't mind lecturing Seattle.
No, it's actually one of my
hobbies. You don't have to lecture. You can just state your opinion.
Yes, but I do think that there, we need to be careful, because the tide is fairly high. You know, everybody's houses are worth ever-increasing amounts of money, and, you know, the unemployment rate is low, and the calf is fairly fat, and it seems like not a big deal to sort of keep creating levies and taxes and things. But then what happens when the tide goes down? And, I mean, let's go back to 2008, 2009 in our memories. So I just think that we need to be careful to not treat it like an ATM.
The property tax, right?
Well, yeah, and just generally speaking, I mean, a number of the issues we may talk about today involve trying to generate money for different programs, and it's easy to do when there's a lot of money flowing, and yet oftentimes those things then don't seem to be taken back when the economy tanks, which a lot of us think it's on the way to doing.
That's true, and I would say that the problem with property tax is actually that kind of uncertainty. If there's a housing collapse, what would happen? But in reality, Seattle is an extremely growing city, extremely wealthy city. We're creating millionaires by the day, and there is no tax on the wealthy. So in terms of what has not been tapped at all, it's actually the wealth of the wealthy. And just to give you a sense, I mean, in 2015, Jeff Bezos's wages, and I hate to call this wages because it's his income, but technically wage income went up by $1.6 million. And that's why I'm laughing, because it's not really wages. You know, who gets wages like that? But his so-called unearned income, meaning the profits he made from his stock value and so on, went up by $30 billion. So his unearned income tax, so-called unearned income tax, went up by 20,000 times more than the income, actual wage income. So that's a completely untapped pot of money.
$28 billion of that was just me ordering household items on Amazon.
It's a very interesting debate, but it's a non-starter. And again, There's a reason why we're one of the few states that doesn't have an income tax. It's because our Constitution says that property must be taxed equally. They have to tax my property equally with your property. And the Washington State Supreme Court ruled that income is property. Therefore, putting an income tax on the rich, particularly in just one city, I didn't go to law school, but it is blatantly, obviously unconstitutional. And again, I don't want to lecture Seattle, but I'd urge the council not to waste their time talking about it.
Supreme Court justices change, it might.
There are edges to the law, but this is clearly unconstitutional.
And not only that, this is a movement-based question. You know, what is our movement willing to do? And I don't think that we have changed society in the past by saying, well, this is what the laws say, we can't go against them. No, if we had said that, I would not have got the right to vote as a woman. We have to fight to change unjust laws. And yes, this might end up in courts. Our movement is well aware of that. We want to have that fight. And when has there ever been a better time to fight than at a time when all across America, millennials are demanding, we want a change in our society.
If it goes through, will Jeff Bezos just move to Mercer Island?
You know what? That's like saying if you raise the wages to $15 an hour, unemployment would go up. It's voodoo economics.
Bezos could move Amazon to the Amazon. I mean, the cloud can be anywhere.
Yeah.
That's the
week, apparently.
Yeah.
They had some problems.
Yes, that's true.
You would have to amend the Constitution, which requires a 2/3 vote of the House and Senate. Good luck with that.
They're calling this a Trump-proofing tax. Is that pasting the name Trump on the same thing that you always wanted? I mean, you didn't want an income tax when Obama was president.
No, of course. You know, you're totally right. In fact, a lot of the people in this movement have been advocates for social justice for decades. But there are also many, many, many young people who are just now getting politicized and radicalized because of the conditions that they see around them as they are growing up. So Trump-proofing is not just a meaningless slogan. It's recognizing the fact that so many people are willing to move into struggle right now because they are alive to the danger that his bigotry and his anti-worker stance and his billionaire-backed cabinet represent. So why shouldn't we use that and begin a real fight for something just?
There's a new Trump Tower in Vancouver, I'm reminded, also happened this week in B.C., Luke, you host events here and there. Would you, if they put you up in the Trump Tower, you have a problem staying there?
I would absolutely move. I mean, I go to Chicago a lot to do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and there is a huge Trump building there that's right across from where they put us. And when you look at that, it looks like Back to the Future 2, when Biff, the bad guy, got a hold of the racing form, and there's a future where he can like win all this money at gambling, and he builds this nightmare tower that symbolizes everything bad in the world. That's what goes through my mind when I see those letters on that building. So I would politely
sort of ask. Comic and dystopian at the same time. Sort of,
indeed, yeah. Indeed,
tragicomic, if you will.
It points out a super serious issue that I just cannot believe is getting not getting more attention. So I do three things for a living. I teach here at the University of Washington, I run my own consulting business, and I work part-time for King County. I used to work part-time for the state, now I work for King County. When I got the job at King County, I had to go through an ethics check to make sure that none of the outside business I did ever was impacted by decisions I'd make as a public employee. That's standard for every public employee in America, except the president. He's running this huge multi-billion dollar business. The conflicts are obvious, and nobody's holding him accountable to it. One thing that's interesting, we're finding out now, that his son-in-law owns companies that are directly related to healthcare, and that's why all of a sudden, and he's been making money off of Obamacare, maybe that's why all of a sudden Trump isn't so interested in repealing Obamacare. Somebody needs to be forcing him to release his taxes and divulge all these business relationships that are directly related to decisions he makes as president of the United States.
Well, we just have to hope that Trump has family members who work in businesses for trans rights and for, women's rights and for everything that we need to get fixed in this country. If he has a personal relationship with someone, maybe it'll work out.
You know, the city of Richmond recently, I think this past week, passed a resolution that is urging that Trump should be impeached for all those emoluments and all that controversy. But really, the main point, though, bottom line, Chris, is that the reason he's pulling back and the reason the Republican Party is pulling back on the repeal of Obamacare is because they know it's not going to work. They have a veritable revolt on their hands. Look at all these town halls where Republican Congress members have either had to face down a crowd that is against them, or they've not showed up. I mean, they're sort of lurking in the shadows, and people are like, where are our representatives? I want to demand a real replacement to Obamacare. That's what people are looking for.
I want to talk about one more.
We need Medicare for all.
We have one more Seattle tax to touch on before we move on to other events of this week, and that is the property tax that Mayor Murray proposed last week. It's a $275 million property tax levy on the August ballot, just dedicated to helping homeless people. And on this program last week, our whole panel was skeptical. Former Mayor Mike McGinn, Seattle Channel host Joni Balter, former State Attorney General Republican Rob McKenna.
They know that the voters are generous and will be very compassionate, and they will not punish the city for mismanaging the budget. They will help the homeless. But they know that if they tax the corporations, corporations aren't as generous, and they will punish the elected officials. They'll go find themselves some new elected officials to back.
But you're not recommending a no vote if this hits the August ballot, are you?
If it goes to a vote, I would vote for it, because I would not punish homeless people because this mayor and council can't manage the budget or won't tax corporations. I won't punish homeless people.
But that's how we budget around here. We take the things that we know that the voters are amenable to, take them outside the budget, and then don't worry about the rest of it because you've already been backfilled there.
And the implicit threat is, voters, if you don't approve it, we're going to eliminate your 911 service. We're not going to deal with homelessness. That's the implicit threat. I just find that extremely troubling.
City Council Member Shama Sawant, would a no vote on this levy hurt homeless people, and would that be fair to them in a city-declared emergency?
Well, homeless people are suffering right now, and as a matter of fact, when the mayor declared, and I agreed with him, a state of civil emergency around homelessness, I proposed, our movement, People's Budget Movement, proposed that we immediately allocate $10 million of the emergency subfund of the city to have increased homeless services. Neither the mayor nor the establishment council members supported me on that. But here's an idea. I mean, this initiative, this is coming to the council for a vote, and then it'll go on the ballot. Why are we using property taxes, which shows complete lack of creativity? You're seeing the mayor and the establishment using endless creativity to say, billionaires, give us your ideas, instead of going to where the ideas really are, which is, why don't we do a much more progressive version of B&O tax, business tax in the city, where you all not only give more relief to more small businesses, but raise more money by taxing more corporations like Amazon. That can be done. You can raise $55 million easily without using.
Why doesn't the city do that?
Yeah, I am looking into it, is what I'm saying. I'm saying that this can be done through the city, and what goes on the ballot could be a progressive tax on businesses.
Yeah, so my wife and I volunteer every Tuesday night at a homeless shelter for women through our church. What everybody's seeing in our communities is heartbreaking. The homelessness situation is worse than I've ever seen it. So I understand the desire to do something. Now, again, disclaimer here, I do communications for our outstanding new King County assessor, John Wilson.
Mm-hmm. And
the property tax bills just went out. And across the county, property taxes went up 8%, and even more in some areas. People think that's because the value of their home is rising. It's not. The main thing that drives increases in property taxes is voter-approved special levies. And we've become addicted to voter-approved special levies in this region because Olympia hasn't given us any other options. So I'm not going to tell the voters of Seattle to vote no, but just understand, if you're worried about how high your property taxes are, it's because you keep voting for special levies.
Why don't the state Republicans fight for taxing the wealthy and big corporations? And then we wouldn't have to do this here.
And if people are worried about how expensive it is for the homeless to live in Seattle, making housing even more expensive by driving up property taxes may not be productive.
What's your idea?
Well, the number one thing is we have to do two things for homeless. Number one, we have to beef up dramatically our community-based mental health services. There are a lot of people who are homeless who should be getting services, and they end up homeless because they're not.
How do we get the money for that?
And the other thing is, we've got to grow the economy. There are too many people out there. I see them every week, really, women who are working in minimum wage jobs and can't afford a home. We've got to create more middle-class jobs.
The economy has to grow faster than it already is?
Yes. The economy is doing fantastic for some people and really not very well for others.
Did you support $15 an hour?
I don't raise...
Well, how do you get middle-class jobs without raising wages?
Because that doesn't create middle-class jobs. It destroys jobs for the people who... I mean, every study shows that raising minimum wage destroys jobs.
That is a separate argument.
There's no study.
There is a rich tech entrepreneur and investor named Nick Hanauer who is heading up this homelessness tax effort, helping to head it up. And he says, I'm going to donate enough money to that campaign to make sure that we would win. It's so far below the amount of money that I care about. Shama Sawant, are you troubled by a rich guy saying, I'll spend enough to pass this thing? And is he the only billionaire you like?
I'll tell you what I'd like. I'd like to appoint a task force of Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, who's about to be a trillionaire, and Nick Hanauer to give us creative ideas on how we can tax the wealthy. I mean, what are the luxury goods wealthy people in Seattle use? I mean, I'm not one of them, so I don't know what they use.
Well, but I like my helicopters,
I'd like
for
to
one.
Tax them. Yeah, the helicopters, the private jets, jet skis, seaplanes. I don't know what it is. I mean, mansions.
Jet ski's not going to get you there.
Let's tax mansions. Let's tax all the luxury goods that the wealthy use. And raise some money. But you know what? You and I are not in that realm. I don't think you're a billionaire. So we need creative ideas from billionaires. So why don't we have a task force of these three multi-billionaires and get some creative ideas going?
I'm just a humble public radio host myself.
Who will host of LiveWire.
We'll be at the Neptune Theater tonight at 8 o'clock hosting LiveWire. But so this may seem like a kind of a ridiculous question, but in reading some of the stuff this week about trying to address homelessness, Hanauer was saying that if they could spend something like $500 million a year on this, it would fix it, or that would be his, you know, his dream scenario. Do we know for a fact that throwing money at this actually fixes it? I'm talking about homelessness now, because it is a complicated suite of issues going on for people. I was on a jog today on Shilshul going by vast swaths of tents and mini Winnebagos, and I don't know if those people necessarily would want to go into more conventional shelter or not. I don't know what's going on with them, but I don't know necessarily, is it just a money thing?
Well, the mayor himself has questioned whether the money's being well spent as it is. So, but, any last words before we're moving on?
Yes, I mean, I think Luke is getting to a very important point. How we raise that money is one political question, but how we spend that money is also a question. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, bottom line is there hasn't been enough resources. That's true. I mean, you know, what works for the kids of rich people is that you throw money at it, you know, and that's how they get good lives. So we do need resources. It's a question of what you do. And that also is something that worries me. I mean, one of the things that has been proposed by the mayor and some of the council members is this program called Pathways Home, which is a one size fits all kind of strategy, which is exactly getting to your point, Luke. You know, there isn't a one size fits all. We need to go to the homeless experts who have field experience as to what actually works. And we need their advice.
Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant, former King County Council member, state representative, chair of the Washington Republican Party, still a Republican.
Absolutely.
Chris Vance. Luke Burbank, host of the podcast TBTL, and more to the point, host of LiveWire, Neptune Theater, live. What time?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
Traffic being what it is, we wanted to make sure people could get there. It's tonight.
There could be a taco truck opening up.
Yes, we tried freeway to organize a taco truck right next to the Neptune Theater in case anyone's peckish.
That traffic jam and more coming up on the Week in Review. Luke Burbank at the Neptune Theater tonight, 8 o'clock.
I just got a text message from my wife asking if I know where the dog's diaper is.
Oh.
That is never a text you want to get when you're trying to be part of a public radio panel. This is also news to me. But
my kids are asking for a dog. Would you just please forward that to me? I just want to show them that. End of discussion.
We have a 4-month-old beagle puppy who I adore, but it is oh my God.
Is it in pull-ups yet?
It's a little terrible.
No. He does it wherever he wants to. He's starting to learn, but oh my God.
Councilmember Sawant, International Women's Day is less than a week away. What's your plan?
Yeah, March 8th, International Women's Day. You know, we had the largest day ever in U.S. history, largest day of protest ever in U.S. history, the day after Inauguration Day, when millions of people, especially women, marched out in opposition to Trump. Many of the leaders of those marches have said that March 8th should be a major day of protest. So I'm, along with a coalition of organizations, organizing a rally on March 8th at 6 p.m. at Westlake. For those of you out there, and I know there's so many like me, if you are really, really depressed or angry, you know, you're wondering what has happened, you know, Trump has got elected, what kind of world are we living in? I'm telling you, protest actions not only work in getting results, they're therapeutic. So join us on March 8th at International Women's Day, 6 p.m. Westlake.
If you're angry, Luke, should you also go to the Neptune tonight for the LiveWire?
Oh, I mean, the catharsis that you will find tonight watching LiveWire radio being recorded can't be overstated.
What's going to be the bigger traffic jam, International Women's Day rally or the propane tanker spill earlier this week?
Well, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, both Michigasses.
Yes, my goodness gracious. I have to say, I take a certain perverse delight, because I don't live in Seattle anymore, but I still listen to KUOW and follow Seattle media. My heart goes out to people that were stuck in that traffic jam, but it's kind of nice to not be in it. I'll tell you that.
You told us that's the number one reason you moved away.
Yeah, I remember that. Right? The last time Luke and I were on the show together, he was talking about that.
Yes, and it's absolutely the
truth. You predicted this week's 9-hour traffic jam.
It feels to me like Seattle is becoming a city eventually. Well, you know who wasn't stuck in traffic? People that were taking light rail.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
True. That's just true.
I mean, I used to live in New York, and it would be lunacy to try to commute by car in New York. And Seattle is just in that transition period, I think, where it's no longer a city that you can really navigate by car easily.
You are exactly right. And this is, back in the 90s, I was a member of the King County Council. I was the chairman of the Growth Management Committee when we did our comprehensive plan. And growth management is based on planning for who's going to be here. And we were told there's a million more people coming to this region. We're never going to build, we're adding a few more freeway lanes, but we're not going to add entirely new freeways. It's never going to get any better. It's no one's fault. It's not Jansley's. It's just Seattle is a victim of its own success. We're growing. If you live in the suburbs, you've got to use transit if you work in downtown. I do. I ride Sounder in and I take buses and I use light rail. If you live in the suburbs and work in a major population center, which soon it's going to be in Seattle, you've got to use transit. And the traffic's never going to get any better. You got to use transit.
Well, the people who were stuck in the traffic, though, are not driving cars because they are, quote unquote, addicted to gasoline. It's because the transit options just aren't enough as where they should be for a
not
city
yet.
Of the size of
You're
Seattle.
You're right. You're right. Where I happen to live I live in Auburn, where I drive for like 3 minutes and I get on a train. And in the middle of the day, if I have to go home, there's a bus takes me right back to my car. So for me, transit works perfectly. But in other parts of the suburbs, it's not there yet. The expansion of ST3 is going to help with that a lot. We're 20, 30 years behind on this. And it's because of decisions made in the 70s where we turned down transit funding. But it's getting there. But the city's just too big now to drive your car when there's better transit options available.
Luke, don't you miss the drama a little bit? A propane truck falls over. It snows. Lightning hits the Space Needle. There's a 9-hour traffic jam. What does Bellingham do for excitement?
There is one street called Sunset that if you're trying to drive it at about 8 in the morning, it backs up for about 3 blocks. So we just avoid that. And that pretty much handles it.
That's the drama.
That's the drama.
I don't know. I graduated from Western in 1984, and Bellingham's a lot bigger and more crowded than it used to be.
It's definitely growing, and it's funny,
it's
though.
Becoming a suburb for Vancouver.
You know, absolutely. You know what's funny, too? And also, they've changed the rules about who can buy property now in Vancouver, and I think that's driving some people down south of the border.
This is the foreign buyer tax.
Yeah. But funny is that,
Vaughn Palmer joins us live.
Even with no actual traffic, you will still talk about whatever traffic there is. My wife and I went around. I'm not kidding. There's like one street that gets backed up, and we went around it the other day, and we're like, oh, thank God we ditched that traffic.
Isn't that true? You have to have a traffic complaint no matter what. You will raise it or lower it to the appropriate level so that you can have a traffic headache.
I love Bellingham. My husband and I go there to relax. He has lots of friends there because he used to live there. I have to say, though, I grew up in Mumbai, so I want Seattle to be denser, and I want better mass transit. I mean, I want world-class transit here.
That could be your slogan, Seattle, the new Mumbai.
It's getting better, but we are way behind.
It was national news that this taco truck opened for business on the parked on the freeway. Would you have been happy to be right behind that taco truck? Because I was talking about this with coworkers. I'm so optimistic. I always think we're just about to start moving again. I think I don't want to see everybody give up. I think I would have been more sad when they start opening restaurants in front of me on the freeway.
I want to know what the moment was in the head of the guy who was running the taco truck when that switch flipped for him. And he was like, okay, we're just starting to cook now. Like, what was the point, that he thought that was a good decision? Because that, to me, it's like you can run and get back in your car and drive, but he's got a full restaurant operating on I-5 at that point. Like, he's not going to just pack that up and start driving when the traffic starts moving.
And ironically, he's open for business because there's propane way further down the freeway that's messing everything up. So my guest, by the way, Luke Burbank, who's running LiveWire out of the Neptune Theater tonight.
Absolutely.
Live, 8 o'clock.
Yep.
Chris Vance, Seattle Councilmember Shama Sawant, who last month called on the city to take its money out of Wells Fargo Bank, and you said quitting Wells Fargo would be a way to take our government back from the billionaires, Trump, and the oil companies, because Wells Fargo is a funder of the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. Seattle did split with Wells Fargo. The city will not renew its contract with Wells Fargo when it expires in like 2 years. This week, Wells Fargo said, okay, you want to leave us? Leave us now. We will tear up the contract. No penalty. No late fees, just cut your debit card with scissors. It'll be done. Don't bend it back and forth. That takes forever. Just cut it. We're done. And by the way, Seattle, they said, good luck finding a bank that doesn't have fossil fuel investments. Chris Vance is nodding. Mm-hmm. And your political statement is going to cost your taxpayers money. Council member, will your political statement cost your taxpayers money?
First of all, that letter that Wells Fargo sent, it sounded. I mean, see, I read that letter. It seems to me like it's very passive aggressive. It's letter. It's like a bad breakup letter by an abusive ex partner, and it's really defensive. I mean, I would say that the reason Wells Fargo is nervous is because they know that this is sort of having a domino effect, and that's great for me as an activist, as an organizer. I would say this is a good thing. Already, since we passed that law, I've had two conference calls with activists from around the nation. You know, hundreds of them asking us, how did you do this? How did you build this movement against Wells Fargo and the Dakota Access Pipeline? We want to do it. It's really taking some shape. And that's what Wells Fargo is nervous about. But as far as not finding another bank, I have some really interesting news to share. House Bill 1209 just passed with bipartisan support, with 73 yays and 24 nays, which is really great. And
it's going to go
to the Senate, and I would say Senate Democrats should fight for it, and Senate Republicans, you know, because it was bipartisan in the House, Senate Republicans should also support it. And this is a bill that will enable credit unions to be a bank of a city like Seattle, you know, so BECU, which is a credit union of a certain magnitude, which could take on the requirements of Seattle. So this could happen. Obviously, Olympia has an incredible ability to screw things up, so you never know, but right now it's looking great.
Chris Vance, you were nodding at some of Wells Fargo's arguments.
Well, once again, I don't live in Seattle. I don't feel like I have a right to tell them, you know, to wag my finger at them.
Go ahead.
But you know, when you're playing with other people's money, which is what taxpayer funds are, sometimes you have to put your values aside. And I was a legislator when we had the whole debate about let's divest state investment funds from anybody who did business in South Africa. Until we found out that just about everybody did business with South Africa, and it would have destroyed the state's pension system to do so. And I was on the county council, and I was the budget chairman, and King County has a lot of money. And, you know, we did not let emotions and stuff drive our decisions about our fiduciary duty to protect the public's funds. It's hard for me to imagine that Seattle's ever going to find a bank big enough to handle its line of business that doesn't do business in projects that are going to offend some politically correct liberal out there. So good luck to the city of Seattle. They can do this kind of crazy stuff if they want to, but it's not good government. It's not good business.
You and Councilmember Sawant were getting along so well.
We agree on Donald Trump and probably very little else.
I did think Councilwoman mentioned that this was a passive-aggressive letter from Wells Fargo. It did have the ring of somebody trying to break up with you before you can break up with them. You know,
I broke up with you. You didn't break up with me.
Yeah, exactly. Like it was. I have to say that they did. I thought make a somewhat compelling case saying that any bank that's large enough to deal with the city is probably going to have some irons and some fires that people find distasteful to mix like six metaphors.
I mean, look, I'm a socialist. I don't believe that Wells Fargo is a bad apple in a basket full of good apples. Obviously, there's a problem in the system itself. This is a rotten system of capitalism. But the whole point is to begin building a movement, and there is so much momentum around the divestment of Wells Fargo because of the energy behind the Dakota Access Pipeline movement. And, you know, as far as Chris's point about, well, you know, the city should put its values aside and do its fiduciary duty, well, the city, by voting unanimously to divest from Wells Fargo, is representing the values of the city, because this is not something that came from above. This is a grassroots movement led by indigenous activists, environmental activists, regular working people who divested their own personal funds from Wells Fargo and said, we want the city to do the same. So this is absolutely something that the city is saying, this is our fiduciary duty to represent the values of the city.
That's not your fiduciary duty. You're having fun with politics. The term, you're an economist.
You're not having so much fun with politics with your approach.
Your fiduciary duty is to do what is necessary to safeguard somebody else's funds. That's what the term means.
Well, but the somebody else, Chris, are the taxpayers of Seattle and the voters of Seattle who are part of this movement, who are saying we do not want to the city to bank with a bank that is playing a premier role in the Dakota Access Pipeline. And also, you know, you can be a naysayer if you really want to be a naysayer your entire life, or you can join the creative side and say, what can we do to eliminate the barriers to the city banking with a credit union. You know, it's not rocket science. It's been done. In fact, North Dakota has a public bank, where Dakota Access Pipeline is, has a public bank. We could have a state bank. Have the Republicans ever advocated for a state bank? No, of course not. And I'm not holding my breath. But my point is that the movement is on the right track. It's a question of winning victory after victory.
I'm just watching this like a tennis match.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Here in the studio. I'm like at the mid-court of Wimbledon. Can I ask a question, Councilwoman? In some way, has the election of Donald Trump been a boon to you and the movement and issues like this?
Well, I think we have to be, first of all, perfectly clear. Donald Trump represents bigotry, hatred, anti-worker hysteria. His cabinet is the wealthiest cabinet in U.S. presidential history. In no way, shape, or form does he represent anything positive for social values or for working people in this country, let alone the question of climate change and so on. But the reality is that we are actually stepping into a new period in history where young people throughout the world, you know, since 50 years, I think, you know, since 1968, this is the first moment where a whole generation of young people throughout the world are saying, we want a different kind of society. Trump has gotten elected at such a moment. So in that sense, I would say that it's not going to just be a straightforward route of Trump, you know, issuing executive orders and everybody just falling in line. No, actually, look at what happened with his Muslim ban. You know, his Muslim ban, attempted Muslim ban, was delivered a stinging defeat by whom? Obviously, there was litigation efforts, and I really appreciate all that. But the real reason why he was pushed back was because hundreds of thousands of people, ordinary people, these are not activists, ordinary people, went to all these airports, JFK, O'Hare, in SeaTac. I was myself in SeaTac for several hours. I saw regular people there who were just, you know, who found the Muslim ban stomach turning and who were saying, I'm going to take a stand. This is, you know, I'm not going to stand on the sidelines. And that is what's happening.
Seattle City Council Member Shama Sawant there. We'll see what happens when Oprah is president, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But we've got the former state chair of the Republican Party, Chris Vance. You don't have to wait for Live Wire. You don't have to wait till Saturday at 5 o'clock, because you can see it live tonight at 8 at the Neptune Theater.
That's right. STGPresents.org is where people can get tickets.
Coming up, Oprah and the Dreamers. Stay tuned. We're live tweeting KUOW's Week in Review at KUOW. Kelly says we need a state bank for this and to Trump-proof our marijuana industry and for new reforms like Medicare for All. Mike says, peeling myself off the floor fainting after learning I agree with Chris Vance on something, this being transit. When you tweet to us, use the hashtag KUOWWIR, that's Week in Review. On Facebook, we're KUOW Public Radio. Send us an email, record@KUOW.org. What's going on with the Des Moines Dreamer? It was national news last month when federal immigration agents entered a Des Moines apartment to detain an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. And they also took in the man's son, who was protected under President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Obama said people who were brought here as kids are dreamers and they can stay. This week, the father was charged with an immigration crime. Antonio Ramirez Paleto has been convicted of felony narcotics trafficking. He's been deported 8 times and he keeps coming back. Councilmember Sawant, briefly, do you want this man to be deported again or to be allowed to stay and get legal status?
Well, look at, I mean, I don't know how what the dollar figure is, but I'm just trying to imagine how much the government has spent in deporting this guy time after time, even though he keeps coming back. I think what we need to understand that is that the system is not working. Leaving aside the humanity question, I think it is just not working.
Is that a reason not to deport, not to enforce a law because people will break it anyway?
Well, we can't just look at deportations and borders in a superficial sense. We have to understand that the reason people have been coming to the United States, even at the risk, grave risk to their lives, is because the economy is not working. They need, you know, they just need to feed their families. And that is the paramount reason people are coming. I don't know, Republicans won't agree with me, but I'm not looking for agreement with them.
I agree with that, but here's
the deal. What our movement is demanding is no bans, no walls, no ICE raids, no deportations, and full civil rights and legalization for all. And there is tremendous support for this.
Oh, that's never going to happen. But what should happen is major immigration reform modeled on what the U.S. Senate passed in 2013. Now, let's first say if this particular individual has committed felonies while here, yeah, he should be deported. But the bigger issue is, you've got 11 to 12 million people here who have been here, and a lot of them for a long time. They've put down roots. They've committed no crimes other than being here undocumented. They should be given a path to legality and allowed to stay. We should not be tearing families apart by deporting people who've been here a very long time, opened businesses, their kids are in school, their kids are American citizens. And in 2013, that bill passed the U.S. Senate with 14 Republican yes votes. Speaker Boehner knew it needed to pass, but he couldn't get it done on the floor of the House. I hope Trump made some sort of vague signal this week that he might be willing to support a compromise that allows that. That I hope so, because this sort of terrible, awful deportations, which tears family apart, it is going to keep going on until Congress passes comprehensive immigration reform that includes border security and a path to legality for those who are already here.
I find it interesting that on a federal level, it seems to me that the people who have the strongest opinions about immigration are not living in places where there are a lot of people from other countries. Like, I used to live in Echo Park in Los Angeles in a neighborhood that was almost all people who'd come from Mexico and Central America, various status in terms of documentation. And, you know, L.A. is a city that has been very welcoming to immigrants. If you look at Republican governors from states that border Mexico, they're actually, like, you're talking about Schwarzenegger, George W. Bush, they actually have decent immigration policies. If you actually are around immigrants on a regular basis, you realize that they bear you no ill will. They just want a better life for themselves. I'm tired of people who don't know anybody who came here from somewhere else having strong opinions about people from other countries.
Meanwhile, we're waiting to find out the fate of that man's son, Daniel Ramirez Medina, the DACA childhood arrival I mentioned. The feds say he admitted to being in a gang, which Daniel denies. Have you seen the written statement that he gave in detention with your own eyes?
Yeah.
It has obviously been badly erased. It said, I came in and the officers said I have gang affiliation. And now the beginning of the sentence is badly erased. So it just says, I have gang affiliation.
And the evidence that has been presented about this tattoo is...
This tattoo says peace or something.
It says peace and it references where he was born, yeah, according to his attorneys. I mean, that is the thinnest, the absolute thinnest premise under which to claim that somebody is a gang member.
Totally. And it's really, it's just sort of the criminalization of immigrants. It's dehumanizing. And we just heard of a dreamer in, I think, Mississippi who was detained by ICE after she attended an immigration rally. I mean, this is chilling. And now we're going to see ramped up workplace ICE raids. We're not going to litigate ourselves out of this on a case-by-case basis. We need a mass movement. We need a real struggle by immigrants. I mean, I don't know how many people were here in America in 2006 when there was a massive immigrant protest and strike. It was a day without immigrants. Immigrants went on strike to say that they are part of this society and they're going to refuse to accept completely unjust bills. There was a congressional bill that was defeated because of that. And I would say there's a lot of buzz around May Day as well. So I would urge everybody to come out on March 6th at Westlake at 6 p.m. But, you know, a big day of our struggle against Trump and against the immigrant haters is May Day itself, May 1st.
I think the key right now for the next 2 years, the key to everything regarding public policy is Republicans, because they control everything, and especially moderate Republicans. The approach I outlined, which was in the so-called Gang of Eight bill, the Marco Rubio bill, is supported by all four of our Republican members of Congress from this state, which is strong border security, yes, but also a path to legality, a compassionate process for those who are already here. Republicans need to stand up and say to repudiate Donald Trump and pass bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform. It has to happen. I'm not holding my breath that they actually do it, but that's what should happen.
Final word on that.
Well, I do think there should be rules and they should be enforced, though. I think part of why ICE is so amped up, and when I was a reporter, I interviewed many an ICE agent, is because they feel like they don't actually enforce the law. They send people away. They come back. People are often in these deferred situations for years and years. I mean, I think that a lot of the people that work in border security just feel like their job is to give people water and put them on airplanes to, you know, just to return again. So I think there should be rules. I think they should be enforced, but I think those rules should be compassionate. And I basically agree with what Chris was saying.
Luke Burbank, who's hosting Live Wire tonight at Seattle's Neptune Theater, who missed each other in Echo Park.
Listen to this lineup of people. We have Matt Taibbi, who's a journalist, T. Bui, who is a graphic memoirist, and the band is Hebu. That is
your,
a, that
Ebes and Ooze.
We really have that. Those phonics are extremely overrepresented in the show tonight.
You got me at Matt Taibbi.
Yeah. He, by the way, is not pulling any punches. His book is called Insane Clown President, if you want to know where he comes down on the current administration.
Formerly Rolling Stone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I lived in Echo Park, too. Did you get the chili powder on the mangoes on the corner?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Shama Sawant, Luke Burbank, Chris Vance, final topic. We've been talking so much about the current president. If he can be president, why not Oprah? Oprah Winfrey told Bloomberg Media this week she can no longer rule it out.
I never considered the question, even a possibility. Oh.
Right, because it's clear that you don't need government experience to be elected president of the United
States,
right?
I thought, oh, gee, I don't have the experience. I don't know enough. I don't know. And now I'm thinking, oh.
Okay. All right. Well, okay.
Which all of that got America saying, oh, is every
that
president
a subtle promotion for her magazine?
For her magazine.
Which is called O.
Yes. Because she never actually said she was running for president.
That didn't even occur to
you. Know, no. This, all she said was.
Now I'm thinking, oh.
That's it.
Yeah, that's funny. But it's really not funny because it's happening. That Kevin dude from Shark Tank, who is like the Canadian version of Donald Trump, is running to be the new leader of the Conservative Party in Canada. I'm afraid that a whole bunch of people are going to copycat everything Donald Trump has done. How do I get elected president? Well, first of all, be completely unqualified and have no experience. Second, be as outrageous as you possibly can. Go to the extremes. Be a populist.
Is Oprah outrageous?
maybe you're going to see some version of a left-wing Donald Trump at some point. And it is, I mean, politics is used to be statesmanship. You know, I mean, you would never elect somebody president who hadn't been a senator or a governor. And there's a reason for that. They have to know what they're doing. Now, the American people are so fed up with our political system. I'm afraid, I don't know what they'll elect at this point.
This is a classic dilemma, I think, for liberals. And it plays out in a variety of different ways, which is, I speak as a sort of liberal myself, I guess, which is you see what Donald Trump has done. You see what Republicans, at least those that support him, have allowed. And then you want to do the same thing, but you also don't want to be the same kind of people. In other words, when I hear that Oprah might run for president, my thought is I'd vote for her. But I'm mad at Republicans who voted for Donald Trump, effectively a TV star. So you have to kind of decide. It's like when you talk about like the deal that was made out of Benghazi, and then you're looking at the raid in Yemen. I was having a conversation with my friend about this the other day. Do we on the left want to turn the Yemen thing into something like the Benghazi inquiry, which we all thought was BS when it was happening for the other folks?
Yeah, and then you get the hypocrite argument, right? So, and which never ends. That, well, when Barack Obama was president, you said this, but now you said this, and it's unending.
I think the also the other point is that. You know, I could shoot the breeze and say clever things about Oprah or any celebrity becoming president or running for president. But, you know, really that's the problem here. You know, that's the problem is that we've been told for generations by the media, by film and everything around us culturally that it is all about a person. So, you know, who is the person that you would like? That's not how social change happens. If you want to really fight for a decent society, that is not how you do it. You build a movement from the ground. And I want to point out something that's really striking that's happening around us in America today. We're talking
First, I want to ask you something, because you talked about the culture of it's all about a person. It's in our movies. It's in our culture. Is it any different in India where you grew up?
No, I'm not saying that. I mean,
I'm not saying it is or it is. I'm curious. Yeah. Is it different in different places?
Well, there are obviously differences in political terrain in India compared to the United States. But pretty much that's what you see everywhere. You know, it's sort of personality politics. But in a way that helps the ruling class, it helps the status quo of inequality and injustice to frame it that way, because then it keeps people busy thinking about which person do I like? Do I like what they're wearing? Do I like how they look? Rather, or are they a good speaker or whatever? Rather than focusing on the politics, actually, like what do they stand for? Do we have a presidential candidate, you know, which Bernie Sanders was, who is willing to declare themselves as somebody who's going to fight for working people, who's going to tax Wall Street, who's going to fight for single payer for all, who's going to fight for an America that actually works for working people and for all the oppressed people who've been left out? Those are the questions.
If you thought Bernie Sanders couldn't defeat Donald Trump in 4 years or so, but you thought Oprah Winfrey could, wouldn't you want Oprah Winfrey to win? I mean, don't you have to deal with the human nature that we have, whether you like it or not?
Well, but I think that is a reductionist view of human nature. I mean,
of course it is.
People didn't support Bernie Sanders because You know, I mean, seriously, in some ways, it was like people were like shocked. Like, here is a 74-year-old, person with gray hair and.
Sounded like a Seinfeld character.
Yeah, I thought he was Larry David for the first 6 months.
I'm deliberately being facetious to make a more serious point, which is that people were not drawn towards Bernie Sanders for superficial reasons. I think we have to give working people, ordinary people, young people far more credit than that. People are smart. They understand what's going on. What they understand, and the bottom line of what they understand, is that the status quo of corporate domination of politics is absolutely not working for them. They are angry about that, which is why millions of millennials of all races and of all genders gravitated towards Bernie Sanders, and that's the clue. And I want to say that one of the most striking things that's happening in the U.S., everybody's talking about Trump. I'll tell you another thing that's happening. Socialist organizations are growing by leaps and bounds. And I want to, and it's not just my organization, but Socialist Alternative, but the Democratic Socialists of America are growing by the thousands by the week. Why is this happening? Because young people in this country are looking for a change to the left. So if we're not looking at that, we're missing a big picture.
So turning to, there's an incredibly interesting article that I read by a Harvard lecturer that talked about the big thing that worries me now, which is the decay of democracy, that people are losing faith in democracy. One of the things this individual pointed out is more and more voters are willing to look at candidates who are non-system candidates from outside the system, like perhaps the council member here. And I don't think that's healthy. That scares me, that people have lost so much faith in typical, moderate, centrist American politicians who have spent their careers working in politics, that they're now willing to look at extreme ideologies and people who are blatantly not qualified. And that's because they're so angry that they're losing faith in the system. And that's not a good thing, because at some point you then finally say, let's just turn, you know, over to the guy on horseback or the guy on the big shiny airplane or the military.
I want to clarify your use of the word American and your use of this council member. I just wanted to make sure that's not what you meant.
Not at all. But I meant just typical, you know, the kind of politicians now that we all love to hate, the establishment. And people are rejecting the establishment in both parties. And everybody thinks that's healthy. It's not. It shows that there's too much upheaval. And people are losing faith in our political system.
We have about 1 minute, Luke Burbank.
I realized something this week that I thought was not a possibility in my life, which is that I would walk across hot coals for George W. Bush to be president.
You betcha.
And those are not words I would have said in that order, mm-hmm. you know, a year ago.
He would be today viewed as an extreme rhino moderate in the Republican Party. It's amazing how far the party.
He is a statesman to me now.
Yeah, he is.
Well, let's build a mass movement of the 99% and fight for a decent society.
Okay, so many Americans not into politics as it is, and they think it doesn't work, and they know presidents hire advisors, so they might trust. Maybe to them, trusting a charismatic young stranger named Barack Obama is not that different from trusting Oprah's going to pick good people, Donald, or Beyonce, or Adele, or Drake. Or Kshama, someone who's well known by one name could be you already have that asset.
Obama was a United States senator who had been a member of the legislature. He got there quickly, but he followed the typical politician career path.
We have to go. Former state to GOP chair Chris Vance and Seattle City Council member Kshama Sawant, who's going to be with you on the streets on March 8th, International Women's Day, and Luke Burbank, host of TBTL, but more importantly, KOW's Live Wire, Saturdays at 5.
Yes.
But tonight, it's a live
recording at the Neptune Theater, 8 o'clock. We'll see you there. STG presents.
Taibbi.
That's right, with Matt Taibbi. STGpresents.org for tickets.
We're at KOW on Twitter. Thank you for tuning in.